Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Emily Dawson, who is an associate professor in the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. And we're going to talk about her new book, Equity, Exclusion, and Everyday Science Learning, The Experiences of Minoritized Groups. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
This is a great book, and it's an incredibly sort of timely and relevant book as well, because it deals with a question about who is allowed into, I guess, who is in control of the contemporary museum. Which is a really live subject, both in kind of museology, but also across cultural institutions in Europe, America, Australia, lots of different places. And I guess the place to start is, where did this kind of come from? Is this something you've been working on for a very long time? You know, is it the kind of core of your kind of academic interest? How did the book develop?
Well, so, I mean, in some senses, it feels timely, and I get that, and people, I do talk to people about these kinds of interests. And I think there's certainly more of a more attention being paid to issues of equity and inclusion, racism, sexism, and how that plays out in the cultural and political landscapes. And so to the extent that sometimes I worry they're a fashion and that is fashions do that it will ebb and flow. And I would like to not see a flow. I would like them to stay on that radar. But for me, it's about 12 years too late. So the book comes from me sort of 12 years ago, Emily, way less grey hair, being working in museums, working in science communication, and sort of being really painfully aware that these were like places that reeked of privilege. And so the whole book, so there's this book and it's, I write these sentences about how this is, you know, a theoretically informed, empirically informed argument about what inclusion could mean and how exclusion operates. And in a sense, I'm almost trying to prove that exclusion is happening and how it works because of discussions back then where people were sort of being like, oh, don't be ridiculous. You're being oversensitive. No. We do a great schools outreach project once a year with a very carefully targeted Gujarati community. And that's enough. I'm ranting, I realize. But like even then, I would say it is as it was then and is now as simple as looking across the gallery. And looking at often a sea of predominantly white faces. And if you get into any evaluation data from institutions, they're mostly middle and upper class. And this pattern is just repeated across all of these kinds of public culture resources. And I think painfully so. So what I was trying to do was provide, I mean, it's a long-winded way to win an argument, isn't it? And be a sort of massive pedant, maybe. But to say, no, look, this is a problem. This is the shape and scale of the problem. And I'm going to try and put together enough evidence, as it were, that you can't argue against me anymore because it becomes slightly sort of impossible to look away from. So that's, I suppose, yeah, it comes from some sort of grudge-holding place.
I mean, you sort of identify, actually, how the issues the book is grappling with and kind of the grudge the book is settling are common right across contemporary culture institutions. Mm. But the book is very specific as well, actually, and it's about science museums. And I guess there's like a couple of things that we might do in terms of clearing some ground for the discussion. The first is this idea of kind of everyday science and learning. Obviously, it's in the title. but also it's got, you know, a specific kind of idea underpinning it. And then I guess there's the context for the institution as well, which is, you know, you're quite upfront about, you know, these are science institutions and they're in London, and there is a kind of like Londonness that we have to take seriously. So it'd be good to hear about, this context of the book.
So I suppose the first, if I start with the everyday science learning jargon, that comes from, the field I work in is the sort of split space around what happens when we try and make science, the sciences, STEM, so technology, education, engineering, maths, as well as science, public. And this idea that science and the public are somehow separate, which is, you know, hugely critiqued anyway. So all this work around making science public, science communication, public engagement with science, that has a very specific, in the academy and practice and policy, quite a specific lineage. And it's about often popularization. In this country, it's about selling science. It has a history of a perception of public mistrust and the need to then sell science back to the public, which is obviously related to a sort of Thatcherite managerialist to justify public funding, tax funding for science. Public have to support science and ideally like it. And that kind of being mobilized and across the scientific community is a way of trying to communicate science to, at, with, or for the public such that they can come to love it in a way that people within the scientific community do, or the science lobby, you might call that kind of work, and that then they support it and the funding's more guaranteed and ring-fenced and so on. So that has quite a specific set of motivations and kind of research or theory space. So you know, the move from communication to engagement, which may or may not be fully realized, this idea of who the public are often being quite narrow, this idea of adding an S to the idea of a public, and that kind of suddenly we have heterogeneous publics and we've solved all these kinds of problems. And there's some amazing work going on in that field, but that's quite niche in its own way. And often, depending on which theories or researchers work or policy documents you're reading, can be quite narrowly understood as purely politically oriented. So it's about public consultations. Or it can be sometimes moved into spaces like science museums, science centres, but very rarely means things like watching TV at home. And then kind of next to that weird academics niche is the academic niche of education, science education, and within that sort of the sub-niche, as it were, of informal science learning, which people, again, there's terminology arguments in both camps, right? And they argue and they fight. So this informal science learning, informal science education, out-of-school learning, they're arguing about, well, there's schools and schools are important, but there's all this stuff around schooling where people might learn in all these different and wonderful and meaningful and lifelong ways that we don't take into account if we only think about formalized school and university institutions. But in that space, the political kind of orientation is often absent, except in a kind of education as a cornerstone of democratic action. So I had more than one long chat with colleagues who are very long suffering about like how in a book like this could I use either set of language? What would it mean? Both kind of theoretically quite different spaces in some ways, although the practices often overlap. Mm. And because I wanted to find out what the people who work with me did quite ethnographically, so it's across 2 years of their lives and it encompasses kind of every science-related interaction, story, experience, perspective. So I really was going from like stuff they watched on TV, stuff they looked up on their smartphones, to science centres, to policy consultations, to festivals. So I went with this everyday science learning term because it did for me this different job of pulling in the bits of science communication, public engagement that I needed to, pulling in the bits of education that I needed to, letting me look at cultural, educational and political practices, but also that kind of sociology of the everyday, sociology of everyday science, and these ideas of kind of popular culture and what actual real humans are doing on the day-to-day that's quite different. And so that's not to say museum visits are daily occurrences for most of us anyway, but to just to try and reframe a little bit what's being left in and what's being left out of that space. So I mean, yeah, I made it up as a term, but I'm hoping for me it was useful. It did a certain kind of work.
No. And I think it works well actually to both at once kind of say we have to think about our institutions, but also, you know, to immediately stop just the sole focus on the institution, because I think you've articulated really clearly maybe two or more approaches to this, but often, you know, the straightforward policy, occasionally academic discourses begin and end with the institution. And, you know, in some ways are kind of saying, well, if certain groups aren't coming, then they're excluded, there's a problem. And actually what's going on is, no, you know, actually everybody is doing engagements with science education almost always. You know, they have opinions, and, you know, that example you give the smartphone, and later on in the book, obviously there's lots of data on this. But yeah, I think it works really well actually to kind of gesture towards a particular direction for the institution, but also to say it's not just about that.
Yeah, and I suppose I'm sort of pulling down on some cultural studies work there, where I'm sort of saying, well, if we think about culture as kind of popular or unpopular, elite, dominant, and I'm trying to mess around a little bit with, well, actually, stuff being beamed into your hand via your phone or your bedroom via your TV every day is there in a way that going to a museum isn't. And there's lots to tease out there, but to ignore the stuff that comes into your house, your hand, your daily life at the expense of the big institution that's really visible and dominant, it's really problematic, and I think contributes historically to some problematic framing in both those fields that then could like kind of recontribute to quite problematic, like ideological, and you could, I mean, I argue racist, sexist, classed framings then of publics by virtue of what practices are recognised and what aren't, and so who counts, who doesn't count, whose lifestyle matters and whose doesn't.
Yeah, and I mean, this is very much the kind of front end of the book now, isn't it? This idea about, you know, we need to critically think about what inclusion and exclusion means, and particularly to think about structures here. And it'd be good to know actually what some of the structures you identify, the kind of things that we need to be taking much more seriously when we think about inclusion and exclusion, rather than just thinking about some groups don't go, or, you know, individuals have taste choices that mean that they'll go, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, for me, a lot of that comes down to real frustrations with the work that already exists, and similarly, I suppose, frustrations with how that gets enacted in practice and policy chat. So I'm sort of trying to make the argument through the work, really, because I mean, I didn't come up with these ideas straight away, don't get me wrong, but to say, well, if you think about how we understand inclusion and exclusion, often if you look at the kind of public science landscape or everyday science learning, actually often at an institutional level and a policy level, is understood that science is just fantastic, wonderful stuff, albeit misunderstood. And these institutions, whether it's you know, a school, a kind of physics schools club, or a science centre or a science festival, they're fantastic. And the problem is that the people who don't go, they just don't realise how fantastic these things are. And so I sort of write about that as a double deficit framing. So like the people that don't go then become deficient. They become not only attitudinally deficient, because they really don't appreciate science enough, but they become behaviourally deficient. They're not doing the right things. Their practices are either invisible or not recognised or misrecognised. So I'm trying to move that discussion on to like, well, actually, first of all, that's a misunderstanding. And then the rest of the book is about, well, look at what people are doing. Actually, they're doing, of course, they've got rich cultural, political, educational lives. Of course, they're doing all this stuff. And actually, if you look at how they experience science and everyday science learning, and you look at their perspectives and their opinions, actually, we can start to see that these have been profoundly shaped by structural inequalities. And the ones I really get most into are kind of around racist practices, around imperialism, colonialism, how this sort of very white, very Eurocentric, often very kind of British and kind of reinforcing British nationalism ideas then to create a sense that science is not for them and everyday science learning is not for them. So the people they see on TV aren't like them when it's in relation to science. That when they go to a science space, an exhibition, say, they don't see stories about people like them. Or when they do, they're damning, pejorative. You know, the one that springs to mind most horrendously is that kind of tired old racist trope of Africa is burdened by disease and a kind of white savior narrative about people coming in with Western science. Now, of course, medicine's amazing. It saved my life, but that doesn't mean those stories are true, and they're really rarefied. And we get into that kind of one story trope. So that story's told again and again and again. And participants, like the people who work with me, they're not blind to that. They're sort of saying, look, we see these stories about Africa and it's always awful, but like, it's where we come from. It's where our families are. We know it's great. We have a wonderful time. Like, these aren't countries of just, you know, so like Sierra Leonean, I'm thinking of two Sierra Leonean nurses who are like, Sierra Leone, we've got a wonderful family back there. We have a lovely time there. And these stories, they're painful. It's painful to see ourselves, our heritage, our culture dismissed in this way and then told in a deficit story. So the book, because the participants are all from like minority ethnic groups or racialized groups in the UK from a UK kind of power perspective, I do try and draw out race quite a lot, but it does obviously intersect with like class disadvantages and gender disadvantages for these participants in particular. So in different ways, they meet different kind of nasty moments where the structural inequalities become really clear. And what I suppose has pained me and continues to pain me is we see lots and lots of research coming out about science and popular culture, science education, science communication, that completely overlooks the effect of structural inequality, which was so clear with all the people who work with me. Structural inequality is why they didn't like science. That's shaping inaccessibility. It's shaping their experiences, but it's completely absent when we look at a lot of the research. So we have really, really interesting research that somehow completely overlooks issues of race and ethnicity, gender, class, or any other kind of intersecting subjectivities related to people's lives, such that structural inequalities are seemingly absent, which I just can't bear.
I mean, one way of really focusing in on that is to think about, I guess, the kind of the role of science in the everyday lives of your participants. And I wonder if we do a couple of things. One would be to kind of introduce them a little bit more and then say a bit about what, you know, the kind of the rich life scientific was for them before we start to think about their interactions with institutions.
So the people who worked with me were, I mean, bless them, what a massive effort to go to. So I was trying to find people who were kind of in a position that they could do sort of everyday science learning activities. So what we know from data, so the data we do have, which is mostly about dominant institutions, is that why middle and upper classes living in urban centres go to science museums, science centres. It's the same for galleries. Zoos, it's a little bit different. Science centres, it seems to be the same. So I was looking for people then from, ideally not from white ethnic majority backgrounds, not from middle and upper class backgrounds, but who still lived in an urban setting that they could go to these kinds of dominant institutions potentially. So I worked with, in the end, the field work was long and I approached lots of groups and, you know, fair enough, a lot of them had no interest in the project, which is very understandable because it's quite hard to take part in a project about something you don't particularly like or want to do.
And indeed, you know, when institutions are in some ways, you know, explicitly or implicitly saying,
not for you.
Yeah, we're not
for you. Yeah, for sure. And like, you know, I'm white. I am now probably inescapably middle class, really. And I was a science insider. So I not only had a sort of ex-science museum background, but they thought of me as a sciencey person as well. So in the end, I mean, happily, five groups went through the project for about 2 years of fieldwork. And that was a Sierra Leonean group, I already mentioned, a Somali group, a mixed Asian group, a mixed Latin American group, and an Afro-Caribbean group. And they, I mean, they're mostly adults, so there were kids, but I didn't particularly focus on the kids. They were all living in either Southwark or Lambeth, so central London boroughs, which is also where I lived because I'm a lazy researcher. And I met them all kind of in one way or another. They were all what you could call grassroots community groups. So they weren't service provision groups, which I wanted to be really careful about because I didn't want participation to hinge on being able to get access to a service. So they were kind of self-forming groups who did stuff together. And they let me just hang out for a bit and then eventually just got used to me being around and would do bits of research stuff with me. And we'd mostly do the things that they were interested in. And so there was a lot of chat in the beginning around, you know, what were their lives like? What did they do? What didn't they do? And some of them, you know, you have that kind of main community gatekeeper people. So some of those people, like, I spent quite a lot of time with and would, you know, babysit for and hang out with, and it got that, you know, you just, like you would with anyone, you get a sense of course people have rich, complex lives. I mean, of course they do. So they would do loads of things. I mean, the examples that kind of spring most easily to mind, if you kind of think about educational, cultural, political, it's like the Latin American group, who were predominantly Colombian, but quite mixed as well. They did, they have a huge Colombian football league, men's and women's, that runs ran an elephant castle and seems to have moved to Ruskin Park more recently. That was over the weekends, massive commitment, super into it. The sort of the dancing, Saturday, Friday night dancing, the jokes about my bad dancing were in every group. So huge dancing culture, huge music culture. And they're all doing like weekend schools for Spanish maths, which they felt their community had a strong talent for, and drumming and dance and music. And they put on like this, do you know the Carnaval del Pueblo? So the kind of the biggest carnival outside of Rio happens in London, is run by the Latin American community in London, and is sort of slightly underground. It's not that well known, shockingly. And so they run that. They're all in music groups. They're rich cultural educational lives, politically highly organized. So a lot of the fieldwork period, they were organizing marches and protests and letter writing campaigns about the fact that they didn't want to be classed as Ibero-American within the London kind of political system, because they, as a result of colonialism, did not identify as Ibero-American, and that was profoundly problematic to them. So in relation to their amazing lives, they're doing all this stuff, as were people in all those groups. But when it comes to thinking about this everyday science learning, there's a real shift in orientation. So there's this idea that science isn't for us, and these kinds of practices aren't for us. And that's reinforced kind of again and again and again. So when we talk about places like museums, we did talk about them because they were, because they're so visible, they're such dominant institutions. So they knew something about them, although enjoyably got a lot of the names enjoyably wrong. So like the National History Museum, questions around whether Madame Tussauds is one of the national museums. So this idea of, you know, museums are tourist attractions, they're really expensive, they're not for us. If we went there, a lot of concern around surveillance, which, you know, as we see in the later chapters, is borne out actually. That it being too, it's far too expensive. And even being in central London, it's too far away. So getting across town to go to them is a problem. Getting there, there's the wrong kind of food. You can't take your family of four and your aunties. And it's just a sort of, it's unthinkable in some ways, although they were visibly recognizable. In a way that kind of, that science as culture space wasn't. So science festivals, science comedy, science talks, public engagement at universities, all of that was completely unrecognizable and invisible. And sort of people had never heard of anything like that. And people had also felt that like local government science-related consultations were completely unheard of. The national government ones weren't specifically heard of, but there was an idea that that might exist. But alongside an idea that they would never be listened to, that it was, their participation was pointless, it was in some way like predeterminedly pointless. And so all of the kind of dominant institutional practices where we see public engagement, science communication, formal science learning, that was inaccessible to them. And I talk about them as fields. So I'm saying these kinds of fields are inaccessible to these groups. And actually their exclusion is part of what makes the field. And if you look at what they are doing, they have got access to some of the popular culture stuff. So science on TV, science on the internet, science through podcasts, this kind of world was more accessible. And obviously so, because it's beamed into their hand or their living room or their bedroom. But even those practices were, like, they weren't the answer. Do you know what I mean? Like, they were kind of still riddled with structural inequalities, effectively. So they're listing kind of famous white men as science TV presenters. They're talking about how, you know, they might watch something, but they're not watching it on purpose. And I make this distinction that they discuss between, like, science as a subject of a TV show. So one of the big blue chip nature documentaries, for instance, which people would watch a little bit. But also science as the background to a show, which was the kind of show people watched a lot more. So like CSI, Big Bang Theory, and these kinds of, so science is a kind of cultural setting for a show about something else that's character-led and narrative-led and has something else going on. And what a couple of them made really clear, so like Gloria from the Afro-Caribbean group, she makes really clear, or maybe it's Connie, no, I think it's Gloria. She's sort of like, well, I don't turn it on purpose. I just watch if it's there. I'm not sort of following these things avidly, although a couple of them were. So we're into this slightly tricky position of they're not doing the dominant stuff. There's some popular kind of less dominant stuff that does make its way through into their daily lives. All of this is colouring their kind of orientation away from science and away from everyday science learning. And the stuff that makes it through isn't enough. So I'm arguing from that, well, actually, if we think about this in terms of field and Bourdieu's work on field, these are inaccessible fields. And part of what constructs the field is that inaccessibility. So the people who are in by virtue of the people who are out. The things that are dominant by virtue of the people that things that are excluded. And it's not then enough to say, well, they're behaviorally or attitudinally deficient, because we can see they're clearly not, because they got all this other stuff going on. It's a sort of non-starter argument.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And this is just made kind of concrete in the sections of the book that talk about visiting the institution and relationships to the institution. And, you know, in many ways, I think one of the things I liked about the book was the sense of almost everybody you're kind of engaged with is acting completely rationally. Because, you know, these are not kind of misperceptions about institutions.
No, because they're right. That's the thing.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to hear about the work you did in terms of things like visits. And, you know, if you're sort of defending cultural institutions, the sort of unfortunate, or, you know, maybe we need to do more, if you're taking a more critical view, the fact that, yeah, you know, these institutions, as you gesture towards, are set up to be exclusive, even in the act of being inclusive, that is, you know, a mode of excluding.
Yeah, so I suppose the sort of the steps of the rest, the way it sort of goes through when the work is, sort of talk about how there were a few people who were more oriented towards science, and how actually because of their social positions and structural inequalities, even being oriented towards science wasn't enough to help them get into science, whether educationally, whether as a career, whether as a hobby, whether through kind of particular dispositions towards certain formats of everyday science learning. And we moved into like trying to think about why, from their perspective, these things were so tricky. And what a lot of them talk about is quite a sort of embodied sense of what, I mean, really, racism, but also class discrimination and sexism, and how these are kind of locked together in this mesh that mean that when they're in these places, they're out of place. And I write quite a lot, because they talk quite a lot, about the extra work they have to do to engage with science and everyday science learning practices. So one of the things we did in the project, when it became quite clear that people, that they hadn't really been to many of these kind of science, everyday science learning spaces, they felt that they were not for them. But they were also, I mean, they're a lovely group of people. They were quite like, well, come on. There was a sort of sense of like, come on then, Emily. All right, well, go show us one then. You show us one. So we arranged visits to places that they wanted to go to. And I should say, of the five groups, only four visited, because the Afro-Caribbean group just didn't think it was worth their while. They were like, no, it's pointless. We're not. Thanks. It's lovely. But no, we're not. We're not doing that. And the other four groups, they visited a science center. And one group visited the science center, and the other three groups visited science museums. And there, I mean, it's just sort of heartbreaking, really. So I'm trying to think of the least grim way to try and tell that story in out loud words. I mean, basically, everything was set up against them. And they, before we went, they had talked at length. I mean, that sort of chapter five is this a very disillusioned kind of, I mean, almost drawing on Afro-pessimism, like the system excludes us, and it's working that way because it's trying to exclude us. It's not a mistake. It is set up to reproduce those kinds of social inequalities, structural inequalities. And we feel like to be in those spaces, it creates an additional burden of labor for us. But also, it's not just the effort. There's a kind of emotional labor attached to being in spaces that aren't for you. And when we go to these spaces, and right enough, they're not for them. And everything, all of their perspectives, all of their expectations are borne out by those experiences. So there's nothing in any kind of community language. And it's not just... And I mean, they're really savvy humans, so they're like, we don't necessarily expect our language. We expect just to see some international languages. So I write a bit about the kind of structural racism inherent in monolingualism in England and Britain. And that's not, you know, that's a choice. Other countries have different choices, but translation is possible. And they were really, you know, they were like, we just would expect to see something. Just a gesture towards the idea of other languages. They acknowledged very quickly that they saw no one else like them in those institutions. So they saw, you know, like Alejandro, the Latin American group dad, he's saying, you know, did you see any other Latin families in there? No, you didn't. Of course you didn't. They don't see staff that look like them. They don't see staff that look like them anywhere, except the Sierra Leonean group, who do meet a Sierra Leonean security guard, who was great. I mean, he was the best staff member for them really ever. And it was really super welcoming. But they still left with a sense of this space isn't for us. These practices aren't for us. Two groups had kind of booked facilitated sessions. One in a science center was, I mean, to paraphrase, really bad. So it was a young man who just perhaps wasn't, I mean, my argument is just he's not trained well enough. Like the support's not there for him to do that work with enough nuance. And he effectively shouts at the three Somali women the entire time and makes them feel really uncomfortable. And it wasn't, I left that because, you know, you've got to remember I'm an ex-museum worker. So I left that visit knowing it was awful and thinking I've got to take them somewhere better. And it took me a few weeks of sort of research thinking to be like, no, your job isn't to convince them that these places are good. your job is to listen to what they've got to say to you. And when I was listening through that transcript, it was only really then when I was transcribing it that I realized he was shouting at them the whole time and like asking them, like, do you know what this is? Do you know what, like, he's sort of trying to elicit a science answer, which they couldn't have given him. And I mean, it was awful. It's kind of heartbreaking. And you know, that this is the issue with like evaluations in this kind of space. Of course, they all told me they had a good day out. And they all very appreciative of the visits, and because they have to say that, don't they? But if you look at what happens, they're patronized, they're disrespected. With examples of racial profiling from security guards, cafe staff, people being told not to touch things, people being kind of hounded out of cafe spaces, which are apparently closing, but no one else is being hounded out. I mean, it sort of goes on, and that's before you even get into stuff about exhibitions, interpretation, the kinds of stories on display, the imagery on display, all so profoundly marked by racist, sexist, and class practices that just reify endlessly the who counts and who doesn't count, so that they come out of those visits knowing that those places aren't for them, with all of their worst expectations totally borne out, and their non-participation is completely rational. And what I try and discuss from that perspective is, so on the one hand, they're excluded, these fields are inaccessible, but on the other hand, they are also choosing to not participate. And that those things are so tightly interwoven that we have to think about them really carefully together, so that you can't kind of fix one without the other. And how on earth would you ever do that? And I suppose that's where a lot of the critique of what I could perhaps critically call tokenistic inclusion practices, or we see a lot of the critique of work around this term diversity or inclusion, that actually these tokenistic inclusion practices that don't systematically change not only the media, but also the science content, can never hope then to change the exclusion practices and the non-participation practices. Because actually what they're doing is keeping the status quo very carefully protected. So we'll do our one thing in Black History Month, which participants were very critical of. And that, as I think Connie from the Afro-Caribbean group says, so we know we're not welcome the rest of the year. So there's these kind of very small pieces of inclusive practice, which are so insufficient that they kind of make the exclusion worse, because somehow doing that is enough, that they don't have to, that all the other changes that are implied by participants' experiences and perspectives can, you know, they never come to be because we're doing this one tiny thing over here and that's okay. So, it's pretty damning.
Well, I mean, what's interesting about the book, I guess, is the sense of, from a, like a critical perspective, you just almost stop there and say, well, you know, we've illustrated the function of the institution here. Mm. But that isn't where the book ends. And obviously, you know, you've got a cautious, perhaps ambivalent commitment to saying the institution can and must do better. And the framework you draw on, you know, just the kind of back end of the book, I guess, to sort of sum it up, is about moving from access and participation to this idea of recognition and respect. Mm. And maybe we'll conclude with you know, some of those themes about what would recognition and respect look like for a contemporary, not just a kind of science institution, but also for a contemporary museum, contemporary cultural space.
Yeah, and I should say I'm a little half-hearted in that last piece, because I sort of suggest, I'm thinking about Mariana Ortega's work on, like, can we be trusted? And we, I suppose, being like white people that work in museums, can we be trusted to do this work? I'm not sure. And that, you know, famous Audre Lorde quote about masters' houses and dismantling things. And is this, so I sort of suggest that, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I am actually pretty pro a total radical alternative. And I think we should think about that. And I think we should work on that. And I'm always happy to see those sorts of projects develop. But I'm also, I suppose, I don't know, sufficiently elderly to appreciate that the fact is we have a landscape of public culture, whether it's science or arts or something else, and that landscape isn't going away. And it maintains this dominant, kind of heavily funded, extremely visible position, and it continues to play these really entrenched, awful roles in social reproduction. So on some level, given that I don't think they're all going to disappear overnight, they have to be transformed, and there has to be a responsibility there around transformation. And I suppose I start to use stronger words like transformation because I don't think we can just do a tiny piece and consider it to be acceptable or appropriate or even slightly enough. And I think we have to go so much further. And I think I'm sort of aware that I'm not sure I can even really imagine what that is, because I am where I am. I've got my own social, you know, I'm socialized in certain ways. I've got my own blinkers on. So I start to try and draw through what it would be. Because I should say, like, the reason I in the book, the way I structure part of that argument is some groups at some times had moments of joy and wonder in those spaces. They were brief, they were disruptive, they weren't necessarily as transgressive as you'd hope they would be. But they did have moments that could be considered meaningful. So I'm sort of trying to think about, well, how can we build on that? What is it we could do to make that more useful? And so I start to draw on that political philosophy framework of like redistributive social justice, but also a kind of relational recognitional social justice, where you could think about what it might mean to not only be redistributing access to these kinds of dominant resources, but also recognizing those popular everyday practices, recognizing lots of different people. So not just kind of white British male achievements, for instance, and recognizing other kinds of knowledge and recognizing that they count. So I'm sort of pushing towards changing not only curatorial interpretive practices, marketing practices, front of house, visitor facilitation practices. But I'm also suggesting we have to change some of the core content as well and what that means. And I know there's a lot of work in science and technology studies around what it might mean to disrupt science or STEM. But I think we have to do all of those pieces together. And that, I mean, I think that looks like a scary change to a lot of my colleagues, and I appreciate that. So in a sense, that chapter 7 is there because I'm really aware, like I say in the beginning, like colleagues of mine, more than one, this kind of idea of, oh, Emily, you've gone and stitched up museums. And like, that's not my intention. But I'm unwilling to hold back on the critique because the people who worked with me, those are their experiences. That's their lives. It would do them a profound injustice not to talk about that. And I also say in the intro that like what I found out shocked me, and it did, but it wouldn't have shocked my friend or my neighbor from a different background. Like it just shocked me because of where I was and what work I did. So I think we have to take all of this on board, and we have to, I mean, if we're going to salvage something from these kinds of dominant practices, then they have to change. I mean, there's also the kind of economic argument. If they don't change, they're redundant. They're dead. They're dead in the water. And that's the end of that. You can sort of, you know, wipe your hands of them. So there is this sort of mild Hollywood ending where I start to say, well, perhaps we, you know, let's think about what would a meaningfully inclusive, informal science learning practice, science communication practice, public engagement practice, or as I put it, everyday science learning practice, what would it look like? What would it mean? And how do we do it? And I'm saying things that lots of people have said before about participatory work, about building relationships, about sharing power, about opening up spaces, and about trying to move away from things like racial capitalism and interest convergence into things that could be more meaningful, that could be more productive. And I think that's going to be hard. But it doesn't mean people aren't doing it. So I do a Hollywood ending, and then I have a really depressing little mini chapter at the end because the Hollywood ending like slightly pains me. I think it's important to think about what we could do, but I'm suspicious, and I suppose have become quite cynical about what that means. And so I do try and point towards projects that I think are doing something. And I think in the 12 years that I've been obsessing about this work, like there are more and different projects. But there's not many. Like I can probably still list them in a couple of paragraphs. And that's pathetic. We have to have much more going on than that. Like we have to do much more. We just have to do much more. So there's this sort of ending around how actually this sort of both a kind of greed, a desire for change, like personally, and a sense of kind of slight resignation that I'm not sure we're going to see it quickly. And I mean, a lot of that is because structural inequality is a massive social problem that we can't easily fix. But I think it is on those of us who research, who make policies, who work in these kinds of institutions to try and make those changes in the spaces we have power and control and say over. Otherwise, what are we doing? Are we saying science and public culture, they're actually only for this narrow group of dominant people who, like, can get everything anyway? And if that's what we want to say, well, great, we can carry on. But if that's not what we want to say, I think we have to take this challenge of change really seriously and think about what it might mean.
And how does that kind of translate into what you're doing now? Because obviously, like, the process of doing, you know, not just a sort of 12-year project, but also an academic book, has, you know, a kind of an end point to it. Mm. So, you know, are you thinking more in terms of kind of activist practice, or, you know, are you kind of thinking in terms of future work that is, you know, even more critical? Like, what are you sort of going to do?
Even more horrible. So we have a couple of projects running. The one that's probably closer to this is we have a project running called Youth Equity in STEM, which is a kind of UK-US collaboration where we're working with practice partners. So we being like this, a small academic team based here at UCL and the Institute of Education in UCL. And we're working with practitioners in a quite different sort of science learning setting. So one's a youth community organization, one's a sort of coding club, one's a zoo, and one is a science center. But they're all invested in doing equitable, informal science learning, so very much in that education space. And we're working with them and with youth as like collaborative researchers, so young people, to try and map out both young people's lives, the practitioners' experiences, and then try and think about what kinds of practices could you come up with in those spaces that would be not just good science learning and not just equity, but equitable science learning. So that we're thinking about that in terms of, you know, what would it mean to disrupt power dynamics? What would it mean to change orientations? And not just change the minoritized youth, as we so often see, but like change the structure of the practices, the institutions, and like somewhat grandiosely the field as well. So that's got a few more years to run, and I think it's really interesting to work like that. So it's quite a different, it's a bigger project, it's a big team, and it's quite interesting to see all those kind of interests play out. I think also I've been sort of obsessing about the work, like some colleagues do in museums around what it might mean to think about like decolonializing science practices, for instance, and that I think is really interesting to think about in this context. And again, I suppose I'm drawn to that because I'm thinking about that. Can we change the science piece as well as changing the medium or media piece? And also in all that spare time we have, keep thinking, as colleagues have pointed out to me, at the end of this, when I finished writing this book, some colleagues and my husband both went, well, when's your practitioner like handbook coming out for that? At which point I did shed a tear because I was like, I can't write anything else. But I think that I'll probably try and do an open access version that is more practice oriented. Because I think, like, if you think about public engagement, like, who are my publics? Well, my research participants are amazing, and I'm still in contact with them, but they're really... they're enjoyably cynical about academic work. So I did invite some of them to a book launch, and they were like, oh, sweet, no, you do your own academic stuff in your own spaces, and, you know, we're all right. So I think publics for me are often the way I think about the people I want to influence is people who work in that sector, whether it's research or practice or policy. So I think trying to tailor something more for them would be really helpful, because I'm so aware this is an academic monograph with all of the joys and limitations of an academic monograph.